Welcome to Inside Analog Photography Radio Program. I'm your host, Scott Shepard, and of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is all about traditional process photography. We talk about instant photography. We talk about black and white. We talk about color film. We talk about dry plate, wet plate, you name it, alternate printing processes, everything going on in analog photography. And of course, the Inside Analog Photography Radio Program is brought to you by Fujifilm over at www.fujifilmusa.com/professional. They have beautiful C41 color neg, black and white, color chrome, and of course, instant. Instant film rocks. These guys have so much great things going on right now with instant film. Of course, they have the pack film in 3.25 by 4.25 and 4 by 5. Color, black and white, high speed black and white. But you know what's even cooler? They have the Instax cameras and film. The Instax Wide is in the country, available everywhere. And of course, right now, brand new, the Instax Mini is now in the U.S. They have cameras. They have film. This Instax Mini is 2.5 by 3.5. It's the size of a business card. This is really fun stuff. You got to check it out. www.fujifilmusa.com/professional, making life more colorful. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab, the place to send all your film to get developed, proofs, you name it. They got a great workflow going. www.richardphotolab.com. DR5. For the most unbelievable proprietary process to turn your black and white film into positives, into chrome. You won't believe until you get your film back as a piece of chrome will blow your mind. The dynamic range, the latitude, it's just unbelievable stuff. Definitely check it out, www.dr5.com. Iger Studios, Lenny Iger, the place to have high-resolution scans done. You know, a lot of people now are shooting analog. They're using a high-resolution scan. They're making digital negatives on an inkjet, or maybe they're going straight to an inkjet output. But they're making digital negatives and they're printing contact prints. They're doing all the stuff you need to get a high resolution scan. They're using an Aztec Premier, 8,000 PPI, adjustable aperture. They can give you scans that are basically grain free. They can adjust it for every kind of film out there. This is crazy stuff going on with Lenny Iger and the guys at Iger Studios. Check them out, igerstudios.com. And of course, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com. The camera strap that will not slide off your shoulder. Our media partners, www.apug.org, the Analog Photography User Group, the place on the web for all things analog process. This is a great place to learn, to share information, to get tips and tricks, the community for analog photography, www.apug.org, and of course, our photographic philanthropy partner, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film, www.geh.org, the place to go to find out about the history of traditional analog photography. These people are keeping this alive. They have over 7,000 cameras in their museum of everything that's ever been made, including the Hasselblads that were shot on the moon. You name it. They have the collection. This is a great way to help support. You can be a member of George Eastman House organization. They have a lot of great things going on, but this is something you can do to help give back to photography, to help keep traditional analog photography alive for generations to come. Definitely check them out, www.geh.org. Today on Inside Analog Photo, we're going to have with us Andrew Kaufman. Andrew is an editorial and documentary photographer, commercial photographer from Miami, Florida. We're going to talk to Andrew about his photography, his editorial work, and how he's traveling across the globe to make this great photography. Andrew, how you doing today?
Great.
Thanks for joining us here on Inside Analog Photo. Great to have you on the show this week. Andrew, tell us about yourself. You're a editorial documentary lifestyle photographer out of Miami Beach, Florida. Give us a little background on Andrew. Tell me about yourself.
Well, thanks for having me on today. I appreciate it. I went to high school in Miami and met a photographer, and I ultimately befriended him and became his assistant and learned the craft of photography, souping my own film and making prints. And by the time I went to college, I knew that I wanted to be a photographer. And went to Western Kentucky University and studied photojournalism. After that, moved to Miami Beach. It was a hotbed of photography in the early 90s and just started producing jobs and continued shooting jobs and being in the photography community, hanging out at the labs and assisting and you name it. I was just trying to get involved in it, just coming out of school. Lo and behold, I guess it's more than 15 years later and now I'm an established professional photographer here in Miami Beach.
So the first time you actually got into photography was when you were in high school, so you didn't have any experience of wanting to shoot pictures prior or anything of the sort?
I did. Growing up, my mother was a very big artistic influence in my life, and I was always in arts and crafts and painting and art club, art school, and just doing all kinds of projects, mixed media, all the things that mothers get their sons to create. If it had a skateboard or a surfboard or it was a guy jumping off a building or something, I'd somehow try to transfer it artistically onto paper. And I'm sure that ultimately led to me being so interested in photography.
It's always cool, and you typically find this, that moms or women in the household are the record keepers. They're the ones that take all the pictures, and it's cool to see that you got this influence from your mom.
Well, it's interesting. My father, he's a salesman, and I got 50% of the art from my mother and the other 50% of my business acumen from my father. It was like a pretty good meeting of the minds there, actually.
So tell me about what segment of photography that you were into when you were in high school. What part of photography actually brought you to the point to where it's like, I want to do this for a living. I wanted to make this my career.
Photojournalism, traveling the world, seeing news events happen in front of me, or National Geographic type work. Those were the most exciting genres of photography to me. And they were easily available. When I was a kid, there was Life magazine still, for the most part. My family had piles of magazines in the garage or in the basement. So poring over those magazines as a kid definitely inspired me. I was always very politically or current events motivated or aware of news happening in the world, even at a young age. My parents always were talking about current events, what's happening in the world. So, I mean, my memories of being a kid are Walter Cronkite and Roger Mudd or John Chancellor. I mean, those guys told us what was happening out there every day.
True old school, hardcore, real reporters.
Yeah.
It seems that there's something missing these days with that, and I don't know what the deal is, but there's just not, I don't know.
Well, I think that Walter Cronkite was in World War II. I mean, it's the greatest generation. These people sacrificed the most, I think, of any American in the short term. And when you have journalists today that don't have the resume, something as big as that, it's just hard to hold a candle to it.
Yeah, it's very interesting the way things have progressed with a lot of things, especially photography. So you learned this stuff in high school. What happened after that? Tell me what happened when you got out of high school. How did your career progress?
It was great. When I was a sophomore, I assisted a photographer at the Miami Herald. By the time we finished hanging out together, people thought we were brothers. We looked alike. We acted alike. We talked alike. We were just inseparable. He'd somehow convinced my father that he was responsible and would take care of me. So I had a very great mentor that was always skirting the lines of danger or taking chances. And it was extremely worthwhile. I got to see firsthand how a photojournalist at a newspaper works. So then by the time I became a junior in high school, I was offered an internship at the Miami Herald. I went into the rotation as a photographer and was shooting assignments on a daily basis. I was even on a team of photographers that covered the Super Bowl in 1989. And was fully aware that when I went to college that I'd be studying photojournalism. That's what I'd prepared for my whole high school career. And I was going to get the education to back up the skills that I had. When I was in college, I had newspaper photography internships. And I spent my college years living across the nation in the summers, being on staff at newspapers and shooting assignments every day. Ultimately, when I finished college, about 50 afternoon newspapers across America closed that year. It was one of the big wake-up calls for the newspaper industry early in the 90s. And I thought, I want to be a freelance photographer ultimately. I want to work for Time and Newsweek and National Geographic. Why should I go ahead and work at a newspaper if they're all closing? So I decided to go freelance right after school. Also at that time, it was, I guess, a concerted effort or focus that I had is that since I had gone to high school in Miami, I knew that South Beach was this huge photography scene. And I thought, I'm done with school, what better place to go live and practice being a professional photographer than a Miami Beach? With models and magazine shoots and advertising and films and productions going on all over the place. I mean, you couldn't shake a stick without hitting a model and a photographer on Miami Beach back in those days. So I jumped in with both feet and had to be a professional on a commercial level.
So how did it go transition-wise from working and doing the internship at the Miami Herald to being full freelance and you're on your own and good luck?
Yeah, the first year or two was a pretty good wake-up call for me to really understand. All of a sudden, I was dealing with people that didn't have the education or the background that I did. And it was just in 18 million different directions of how do you price something or how do you approach the subject or the project or what are you going to do to produce the segment. It just taught me I have to rely on my skills and follow through with my instincts. And ultimately, I prevailed because here I am now, more than 15 years later, still freelancing. I've never had a full-time job in my career.
So you've never actually worked for anybody as an employee, really?
No, never.
Wow.
That aggravates a lot of people, too. I went from interning in college to going freelance, and I've been freelance my whole professional career.
Pretty cool stuff. So let's talk about how you differ from other photojournalists is you shoot film and a lot of it.
Yeah, I mean, I learned back in the golden days of photography, I would call them, shoot a job, hand process it, hand print it, and deliver it to an editor. I think Miami's a fascinating place, and I learned coming out of college, everything was 35 millimeter black and white, newspaper photography, and then when I hit Miami, it just opened my eyes up to all these different formats and films and processes, and it gave me the opportunity to see that there's more than one way to skin a cat. So very early in my professional career, my eyes were opened up to the equipment that was not 35 millimeter. Hasselblads, Pentaxes, Mamiyas, Linhofs, or Wissners, or all these different cameras. And so I just started practicing with them all. And working with the labs here in Miami, you can get anything processed in 2 or 3 hours. E6, C41, or black and white, enlarged contacts, you name it. Miami Beach had 10 or 12 different labs in it in the heyday. It was a great opportunity and proving ground to really practice and hone in on your style of photography. And that was probably one of the greatest times in my career to sit back and think about how would I approach a project, what piece of equipment would I use, and give that image my photographic signature style.
Let's talk about the environment for analog photography in Miami Beach. And I guess all of Miami, including Miami Beach, doesn't seem to be very friendly anymore for the analog photographer.
Well, it is. You just have to find the places that are going to help you finesse that. But there's not a store really where you could go and buy film and paper and chemistry. You have to be in the know, unfortunately, because they become smaller, more boutique businesses that handle analog photography. And luckily enough, I've been here long enough to know where those places are.
Well, no, I mean, it's really odd that, and it just goes to show you what's going on here, is such a large center like Miami doesn't have any good places anymore. I mean, there's a few, but like you said, there used to be dozens. Like you said, you can't even buy film. I mean, what are you going to do? I mean, it's really difficult, and I guess it really goes to show the support for analog photography by these vendors, because they all want to sell a digital camera or a memory card or who knows what.
Yeah, retail has really taken over the photography industry. It just seems so much more of a mom-and-pop genre or industry. Post-digital, it's all about business, for sure.
Exactly. So let's talk about what you're doing for your workflow. Tell me about your gear. What are you shooting with these days? What are you digging?
My mainstay is a Hasselblad 6x6, and I guess the brother and sister combination to that is a Pentax 6x7. So depending on if I want to shoot a square or a horizontal, it's either a Pentax 6.7 or the Hasselblad 6x6.
And let's talk about the square format. We've chatted about this before, but let's talk about the reason why you like shooting square. Is it because of the gear or is it because of the format and you would shoot square if it was on a Pentax or a Mamiya?
No, I mean, shooting a square picture with a Hasselblad is a very thought-out process. Even if it's off the cuff, it's just going to give you a different look and a feel than a horizontal image. And I find that to be refreshing or challenging. And I'm always challenged by photography, and I wanted to be able to create a fascinating composition within a square. It's a very difficult medium to create pleasing composition. And so that challenge to me is what makes photography a wonderful experience.
So let's talk about shooting with the Blad. Do you shoot with a waist level finder? Or are you shooting with a look through finder? What are you using with your gear?
Yeah, I have, I think it's a PM finder. I look at a 45 degree angle into the camera. Not right behind it and not right over it, but I guess at a 45 degree angle.
Do you find that to be easier to deal with than a waist level finder?
Yeah, I wanted to be able to look through the camera and right at people. I'd actually learned medium format photography on a TLR. And that's great, and it's a good learning experience, but for speed and comfort and professional use, regular viewfinder just seems to be the best approach for me. I wanted to have the speed and comfort of 35 in medium format, and that Finder gives me the chance to do that. Because I would always do a lot of sports photography with the Hasselblad or action photography, and I think that look of sports photography in a square is awesome. So that's one of the reasons I use that PM Finder.
Do you use a light meter separately? Do you use a meter viewfinder that's in the Blad?
No, I have a handheld meter, and that's what I use basically for all my exposure and any of my photography. Really? Just find it to be more consistent and trustful.
Well, exactly. Do you meter everything, or do you sort of get into a point towards like, yeah, this is about right, I might hit it once and then just roll for an hour or two and check it later? Are you pretty spot on each thing?
Yeah, I'm pretty spot on each thing. I mean, Miami photographically can be a tricky place, and if you wait 5 minutes, the weather will change. So sometimes the exposure is F8 and sometimes it's F4, and I'd hate to be two stops off on anything.
So it seems that you really learned your photography skills shooting chrome.
Oh, yeah. Initially Kodachrome and then E6. Tons and tons and tons of E6. Clip tests. Front snip, back snip, quarter push, half stop pull. Even though you see the Polaroid and you take a reading, just depends on what look you want the subject to have in the final product. Depends on how much you might want to push the test back in the day. But gray color neg films are so good nowadays. I haven't even touched E6 in years. And I actually feel like I was a color neg convert very early in the 90s. I was shooting Vericolor while many people were still shooting EPP or Fujichrome. I was shooting Vericolor 160. It was just a nice, uncontrasty color neg film. Kind of a wedding photographer's film, but I guess because of my fashion background here being in Miami Beach, I was seeing so many people use that film, and I just thought it had a great quality to it. And I guess Vericolor has basically morphed now into a Portra.
Yeah.
If you would trace Portra back to its old mother and father, I think it's Vericolor.
Let's chat about that. What are you shooting emulsion-wise? What are you shooting for your film stock?
Well, if it's black and white, it's going to be Tri-X, bar none. It's just what I had the most experience with. Pro-Pak, 100-foot reels, bulk loading, 35, 120, 4x5. It's always Tri-X in black and white. And in color, yeah, the Portra films, they're pretty fantastic. And then I use a little bit of Fuji. I really like Reala. I think that's a really nice film. I think it's a film that hasn't really been monkeyed with too much. And Reala is good today as the day it was introduced. I have a stockpile of Polaroid 55 and 6.65 I use. And for me, it's more about what camera am I going to use than really about the film.
Excellent. So let's talk about some of these projects that you've been doing. You've been going on some far-reaching trips to shoot that weren't even really commissioned editorial work or photojournalism stuff that was basically you wanted to go and you split. So tell me about some of these trips that you've been going on here and the thought process behind why you would just pack up and head off to India.
Well, from a young age, my parents traveled and always took me along. Sometimes we would go for the whole summer or sometimes they would send me to summer camp. And so every summer as a child and then a teenager and then going into college, I was always somewhere else than where I lived during the year. And I kind of thought about it just getting out of school, out of college, and I thought, well, it's a summer, where am I going? And in college, I'd gone to four different newspapers and lived in four different places across America. And so my first year out of college, summer came around, and I thought, all right, now is the chance for my journey. And so, for some reason, I had that realization and just continued on with that summers abroad from when I was a kid until now and as an adult. So this summer, I was in India, and I just got back.
So how did you plan a trip to India? Was it just like, I'm going to buy a ticket on this date, and I'm going to return on this date, and whatever, man? Or did you plan out stuff like you were super vacation boy and figured out I'm going to go to this spot and this spot? Or how did you work that gig? Because India is a huge country and a lot of stuff to see, and I'm sure much different than Miami or Orlando.
India is much different than Miami and Orlando, except for the weather. It was hot and muggy the whole time.
So you were used to that, so it didn't bother you?
That wasn't the big deal about it, no. Initially, I started with booking the plane ticket on two certain dates, a departure and arrival, and then I started planning my trip. I thought, okay, let me get there and let me get home, and then once I'm there, I'll figure out my itinerary. So I knew where I was arriving, and then I started doing research to where I was arriving and the things I wanted to see and do. And then I kind of had an itinerary of the places that I would go to from where I arrived. I started in Mumbai, and then I went to Delhi, which is the capital. And then in Delhi, there's a road trip you can do, and I sort of made this circle and returned. And then I flew around a little bit, just tried to experience the things that you just can't experience unless you're in India. And that was really the goal or the focus, is seeing the Indian culture and the life.
Did you have a guide to a point? I mean, how did you research where you thought you were going to go? Or was it just, wow, that's a cool name, I'm going to go to that town?
Believe it or not, I got a magazine in the mail that was an all-India issue. And it was like getting a National Geographic when you were 10 years old and just being amazed at what kind of world is out there. Believe it or not, that magazine inspired me to see India for myself. It was a very thorough report on India. I had to see it for myself.
When you go on a gig to India, being it being a much different environment than anywhere in the U.S., was there any concerns when you went there? Did anything freak you out when you got there? Tell me about your experience of being in India compared to hanging on Lincoln in South Beach.
Yeah, Lincoln Road. I took a lot of medical precautions, which I'd always taken on any of my previous travelings abroad. I'd made sure I had the proper immunizations and some rudimentary pharmaceuticals for coughs or colds or sicknesses you'd pick up on the road. Besides that, I just brought a lot of sunscreen. India didn't feel like a dangerous place to me. Everybody smiled at me the whole time. Everybody was really courteous and kind. And it was just a great experience. I guess the trepidation was more in me than actually being worried about being mugged or robbed. I didn't have any of those situations whatsoever. It's a friendly, warm, and kind, and opening culture.
Did you find it was economical to travel through the country and accommodations and food?
Oh, yeah, it's economical for sure. It just depends on how comfortable you want to be. You could spend $10 a day on a room, or you could spend $100 or $200 or even $1,000. So it just depends on the level of comfort you're looking for.
It seems interesting, though, to spend $1,000 or even $200 or $300 on a room to be in this super comfortable Western-style environment and then step out on the street. Would be such a large variation in environments that it would be almost sort of trippy to be this really plush deal and then go into the street.
Yeah, the dichotomy is huge there, and sometimes it'd be nice to get a little break from the difficulty or the quality of life and stepping in and out of worlds. But the upper class culture in India is equally as fascinating. They have their rituals or customs or traditions just like the lower class there. Sometimes they actually mix during the religious holidays. That's always interesting to see also. I was there during the Ganesha festival, which is a Hindu ritual where they cleanse their deities, their gods. And that was very fascinating to see that firsthand.
What did you concentrate on when you were there? Were you more concentrated on shooting people, shooting landscape? Were you trying to document some type of event, like you had just said, what was going on there? I mean, what was the goal behind going to India?
Yeah, just to sort of lose myself. Just to get a break from the daily life and wander around with my camera and enjoy life. And usually when you do that, the pictures come pretty easily. So that was really my goal. I mean, I had things I wanted to see. So that was the plan for the most part. See what the culture's like in India and talk to people and get a chance to understand how things work. I guess to a large extent, my instinct kicks in and I know where to look for photographs. Or the things that I want to see and do, or sometimes I look for the same things when I go to different countries abroad, or sometimes I look for what makes that culture unique, and it was a great experience, a great chance to just see the world.
Let's talk about some of the other trips, because you've done also some other different editorial work, you've done a fair amount of travel, so how did your other travel experiences help you out with the trip to India?
I think every trip I've ever taken hopefully helped me prepare for India. It's not the easiest place to travel, but it's not impossible. And that experience helped make it easier, see more, do more, experience more. And all of my travel around the world, that always benefits me. When to get on the plane or how much to carry. Even though a place might look great on the internet, when you're there, you kind of know realistically more how it looks. What are the places you want to go to relax? And then what are the places where you want to go to do a tour or a hike? India's huge country and it's very varied, so you could be in the city, you could be in the country. And during my trip, I saw those big changes between the cities and the rural areas. And that in and of itself was intriguing to me.
The project in India, is this for your portfolio? Is it something you want to do a book on? After you get back, you get all this film developed, you have all these images in front of you. What do you do next?
The main goal from this project for me, before I took the trip and now that I've returned, what I want to do is get in the darkroom and make a set of prints of my favorite images from the project and create a portfolio of that time. And ultimately, that project would be collected. And that was my goal for this project, is to create a handmade portfolio of the prints from the project. I'm sure once I get the prints made, I might look for a gallery opportunity. But I think right now it's too soon for a book project. I was only there for a month, and that's not necessarily time enough to create a book project. I like to create the body of work, print it, and then think about how am I going to improve on it or change it or expand it. Just gives me a chance to think about the work in its entirety.
Do you find that you have better luck selling off a portfolio of work to collectors than just a print here and there? How does it work with what Andrew is doing when it comes to ancillary income? I mean, of course, magazine comes to you and says, shoot this package for us, great. Do this assignment, great, you get paid. But let's talk about other ways of income generation that you're using for these trips and this other ancillary photography you're doing besides what you've been commissioned to do.
Yeah, it just depends. Sometimes I sell pictures with singles. But most of my work, the way it is created, I don't really do one-off photographs. Usually, if I have a photograph, it's part of a larger project. And so, to me, it just makes the most sense to create a portfolio of those images. So, creating a set of photographs as a portfolio, that it's really meant to be seen as a project, not just one image here or one image there.
Very cool. So, let's talk about some stuff that you would like to do that you haven't got to go shoot yet. I'm sure there's some geographic locations that you would like to go scope out. But is there any other types of projects you're looking to do besides going off and shooting destination photography?
Well, I think that in all of these places that I've been, there is a common thread through all of that work, and it's really about the people of the world. And ultimately, a goal would be to have a series of portraits of people from every country in the world. I'm sure that'll take a lifetime to amass, but that's something I definitely work on in each place I visit. And I guess the one continent that I really haven't traveled yet is in Africa. And so that's on my short list for sure.
How about editorial work? Is there any types of things that you've liked to do that's different that you've not been able to shoot so far? I mean, you've been doing this great editorial work and doing event coverage and doing a bunch of cool, crazy things on top of it. But is there anything that you really like to do editorial, photojournalistic-wise, some type of event? Are you looking to go to Afghanistan and hang out in a Jeep for a couple months?
No, I've been shot at before, and it's not too much fun. The one project that I've been working on now for about 5 years is about the expansion of the Panama Canal, and I make trips there often to photograph the expansion of the canal and the globalization of Panama, and that's something that I have a keen eye and put a lot of effort towards now, is working on this, what could be one of the largest engineering projects in the next century. The expansion of the Panama Canal is going to be able to handle post-Panamax size container ships. And the world cargo in the next 10 years is going to be more than 70% post-Panamax ships. I think it's a fascinating time in the history of Panama, and I want to be documenting that in this transition. So I've spent a lot of time focusing on that project, actually. Photography is a fascinating process. And I think that when people have a chance to process the film themselves and make a print of a roll of film that they shot, that it's just an amazing experience. And to be able to spend a lifetime seeing the world and experiencing that, it's just going to produce so many special moments. It's important that there's other people that want to take on this tradition and profession. It's a real craft, and I think that in the digital world, it might be a lost art. With my film photography, it's actually easier for me to go out and shoot a film picture than it is to shoot a digital picture. Because when I'm shooting a film picture, I know exactly what the picture is going to look like when it's printed. And I know the best way to develop it and get it to that print. And quite frankly, it doesn't take me that much longer to get it to that final image than if I shot it digitally. The lab I work with, they process my film. They get the whole roll. They scan it all at once. And then they make a contact sheet out of it. So I'm a digital photographer, but I'm shooting with film. And that helped me make this big transition and leap. And that's what I would recommend to photographers, because it became very important for me to have my work digitized. And that was a big hindrance to me early in the digital world, is that if I went out and shot digital, then I could put it on the internet immediately. So luckily enough, I figured out a way to bridge that gap and to be able to shoot film and then still be able to post that work pretty quickly on the internet, or wiring it to a client via FTP or email or whatever the delivery method was. It was just really important for me to put my photographic style on an image, continue shooting film, because it's just such an easier medium to store archivally than to worry about, do I have the latest plug-in or upgraded cards or the latest camera? I would rather have spent the money that I did on my own personal projects on film and processing and plane tickets and hotels than on another camera, because the cameras that I bought early in my career, I still have today, and they do pictures as good today as they did then. And all of that work is still what I feel is light years ahead of anything digital.
What do you see from editorial clients that want a package shot? Do you even tell them I'm going to shoot it on film? Do they specify we want digital, we want this? What do you find when you're out doing a gig for Newsweek or whatever you're going to go shoot? What are these people asking for? Or they're not asking for stuff. They're just saying, send me the images.
Sometimes they just say, send me the images, but most times we talk about the treatment. And I think that's what photo editors, they like to be a part of the process. They say, how do you envision the story being photographed? Sometimes it might be panoramically, or sometimes it could be a large format image, or sometimes it just depends on the project. And is it for a weekly magazine? Is it for a monthly magazine? Is it for a monthly magazine where the story is 6 months out? I think the editors ultimately probably don't really care how you get them the picture, or if you shoot a digital or film, as long as it has the look that they envision for the project. Sometimes I'm deferred to. They're like, shoot it any way you want and deliver it on Tuesday. Every project is on a case-by-case basis. My predilection would be to shoot it on film, even if it was for deadline that night. If I start early enough in the day and make the image I need, by the end of the day, I can transmit a film scan to the client. So it's not that hard.
So you found that you're not being alienated by photo editors because you are shooting film.
I don't think I'm being alienated, but I guess I don't know what editor would say, well, we're not going to go with Andrew because he's only shooting film. I mean, I guess if I'm forced to, I'll shoot digital. But it wouldn't be my first choice normally, though. So I can't imagine. I wouldn't be chosen strictly for the sense that I don't shoot digital.
So what would you give as a little tip or a pep statement to people that want to get into photojournalism that still enjoy to shoot analog photography?
Be independently wealthy. I guess I really wouldn't want to be a student trying to break into the professional world right at this moment. It just seems that the recession is as deep in the media world at this point now than ever in the history of mankind. But if you have great work and great ideas and great projects and you believe in them and you show that work around, it will get recognized, because there's young, determined people out there every day that are out there. The trick is, how do you make your work look different than everybody else's who's ever come before you? And I think that's a question that all professionals ask themselves every day and on every new assignment.
Is there anybody that's really had a heavy influence on yourself photographically? Is there any photo hero you have?
Yeah, I mean, the work that inspired me quite a bit early in my career was definitely Cartier-Bresson, Marc Ribot, and the life photographers in the heyday, Co Rentmeester and John Dominis, Mark Kaufman. Those guys were working on a magazine and making pictures day in, day out, traveling. That really gave me my initial inspiration. My inspiration now really comes from a lot of different genres in photography. Guys like Walter Yost or David Burnett, even as varied as Bruce Weber and Arthur Elgort or Paolo Reversi. My tastes are varied, and the inspiration, sometimes it's anonymous. I look at so much photography, but I know what I like when I see it, and I'm constantly trying to expand that vision. But I like to ultimately create work that is classical in a sense, that if you saw the image, you would start asking yourself, well, was that shot in the 50s, the 60s, the 80s, the 90s, 2000s? And I like to put that kind of unknown time stamp on my work. Unless you saw a piece of technology in the image, you'd have a hard time figuring out if you saw a print of it. Was it recent? Was it vintage? And that's something I constantly am striving for, is creating timeless imagery. I wouldn't want to create too many bodies of work that would be dated, so to speak. That's something I'm always working on.
This is very cool and great photography here, Andrew. So tell us where people can go look at your site, your blog, your archives. You got a lot of great stuff up online that people can actually go and look at and enjoy.
Yeah, I have a website. I'm not such a great inspirational blogger. I don't blog. On my website, I have a paper blog. Those are my journals, and you can go and have a peek inside of those. That's at www.andrewkaufman.net. Kaufman's K-A-U-F-M-A-N.
Yeah, great stuff. Beautiful photography. I really appreciate you taking time to chat with us today to tell us about what you're up to and your inspiration. And this is just beautiful photography and great work.
Oh, it's been a pleasure. I appreciate your time.
Well, there you go. Andrew Kaufman, beautiful work, unbelievable travel photography, a lot of great documentary editorial work. Andrew's doing some great stuff. You definitely want to check out his website. He's got some beautiful photography. The Inside Analog Photography radio program is brought to you by Fujifilm, making life more colorful over at www.fujifilmusa.com. Our friends at Richard Photo Lab at richardphotolab.com. DR5 over at www.dr5.com. Iger Studios over at igerstudios.com, Upstrap at upstrap-pro.com, and of course, our media partners, APUG, the Analog Photography User Group over at www.apug.org, our photography philanthropy partners, George Eastman House International Museum of Photography and Film over at www.geh.org. I've been your host, Scott Shepard, here on Inside Analog Photography Radio. We'll be back next week with more great analog photography.